Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And this talk will mostly be based on a paper from about half a year ago in collaboration with Joe Marzano, Shiraz Minwala, and Toby Wiseman, and also on a few other projects that I've been working on with these collaborators and also with Kyriakos Papadorimas and Mark van Ransdonk. And a few of you maybe heard already some talks from some of my other collaborators, so hopefully this will be different enough to still be interesting. I'll start with giving a general introduction about what it means to study gravitational phase transitions from a field theory perspective. I'll then describe briefly an example that's hopefully familiar to most of you, which is the example of black hole formation in anti-de Sitter space. And the main example that I'll discuss, which was analyzed in this paper, is the black hole, black string phase transition in gravitational theories on a circle. So obviously, as physicists, one of the main things that we study about theories are, is there a phase structure? What are the phases that a given physical theory is in? And we can study that question either in the sense of the microcanonical ensemble, namely we can ask, given some theory, what's the generic state of that theory at some energy, and there can be phase transitions there as a function of energy, where the generic state goes from some form to another form, or we can ask the same question in the canonical ensemble and ask, what does the thermal state of the theory look like? And again, we can have transitions between different phases there. So this is, of course, the general thing that we do in physics, and the same is true for theories of gravity. Again, we can have various different phases in these theories of gravity. One famous example in the microcanonical ensemble is that if we take, say, a weakly coupled string theory, then we know that at relatively low energies, the generic state of the theories is some massive string mode at energies that are bigger than the string scale but smaller than the Planck scale. And then as we raise the energy, then there's a transition from that to a black hole as the energy goes above the Planck scale. And at least classically, this is a phase transition in the sense that these two types of objects have very, very different properties classically. So that's an example of the types of phase transition that we encounter in theories of gravity. And another example is this black hole, black string transition that I'll describe in detail later in this talk. So this is all very general. Now, what we've learned in the last few years, which makes this more interesting, is that many backgrounds of string theory, so many backgrounds of string theory are equivalent to field theories via the ADS-CFT correspondence and its generalizations. And in many cases, these string theory backgrounds also have a limit where they're well described just by classical gravity, namely a limit where the string coupling is weak and the curvatures are small. So there's a limit where the string theories are well approximated by gravity. And from the field theory point of view, that usually corresponds to some strongly coupled limit. And this correspondence then allows us to translate between the phase structure of gravitational theories and the phase structure of strongly coupled field theories. So that's how we can translate these gravitational phase transitions into statements about field theory and view them from a field theory perspective. Now, in many cases, on the field theory side, there's also some coupling constant parameter that we can tune, such as the achieved coupling in large N gauge theories. And then we can also study the same theories in the opposite limit, where it's a weakly coupled field theory. And this, of course, generally maps on this side to having some strongly curved background. And again, we can identify the phenomena on both sides here and learn from the phase structure of these weakly coupled field theories about the phase structure of strongly curved gravitational backgrounds, or vice versa. Sure. Yes. In which case? In this case? Well, in this case, this is in the microcanonical ensemble, so I'm not sure exactly how to define the order of the phase transition. I guess you can ask some questions about it, but anyway, this phase transition is not really very, very well understood. So I mean, we know that it exists, but there are no good tools really to analyze it. The case which is somewhat analogous to this is this case of black hole formation in anti-de Sitter space, and there we do know how to analyze the corresponding question. So in that case, we do know how to answer it, but for this transition just in flat space, it's not really well understood yet. And the order of the phase transition, Well, just in classical gravity, you could add, I mean, these sort of this thing has a horizon and the other thing doesn't. So you can construct some order parameter that's based on that. And again, I'll give examples of this later on. Presumably, if you're beyond the classical limit, I mean, for finite string coupling, presumably there is no order parameter that distinguishes these two phases. So they're really, I mean, I think we all believe that black holes are also just quantum states in the theory, just like massive strings, and that for finite string coupling, there's no real distinction between these phases. So presumably, the phase transition between these things gets smoothed out at a finite value of the string coupling. That will actually be true for most of the phase transitions that I'll analyze here. So on the string theory side, we always have some parameter G string, and on the field theory side, that will map to some parameter that's typically 1 over n in a large n gauge theory. And most of what I'll discuss in here will just be in the limit of G string going to 0, which is the limit of classical string theory. And in this regime, it will be classical gravity. Here, it's going to be classical string theory on a strongly curved background. And this limit maps here to the large n Etouffed limit, where we only have planar diagrams in the field theory. And in many of the cases that I'll discuss, it will be true that there is a distinction between these phases in the classical string theory, but that distinction will disappear once we turn on the string coupling. And similarly, on the field theory side, there will be phase transitions that are sharp phase transitions in the large n limit, but that will be smoothed out at finite n by 1 over n effects. So that's sort of the general story, and I'll give two examples. So I'll discuss that in these two examples, and hopefully that will make it clearer. So just to finish this general story, so given this picture, so there are several things that we can do. So one thing, of course, is that we could work up here, and we can map these gravitational phase transitions to phase transitions in a strongly coupled field theory. And that's often useful because it gives us a completely different perspective on these phase transitions. And on the gravity side, these phase transitions usually involve black holes, and one thinks of them as in a particular way. Well, in the field theory, these usually map just to standard phases of field theory, and so this gives a different perspective. And in principle, of course, if we knew how to solve strongly coupled field theories, then we'd also just be able to use that to solve for the phase structure of gravity. But usually, we don't really know how to do that. So in practice, the correspondence here is, well, usually we know how to solve for the gravity side and learn from that about the strongly coupled field theory and not the other way around. But still, this translation is often useful just conceptually to getting a different perspective on the gravity phases. So one thing we could do is study this relation up here. The other thing we could do is to try to study the phase structure of the weakly coupled field theory just by perturbative methods. And then this tells us that we can translate that into the phase structure of these strongly curved string theories, so which are sort of gravitational theories with a stringy corrections. So studying the weakly coupled field theory teaches us directly about the phase structure of these field theories, of these strongly coupled string backgrounds. And then we can also ask whether this phase structure that we find at weak coupling is the same as the strongly coupled phase structure or not, namely whether the phase structure changes when we change the coupling or not. So in some cases, as we'll see, the phase structure is actually quite similar at weak and at strong coupling. And then that basically tells us that nothing dramatic happens as we increase the coupling on the field theory side or as we change the string scale and the size of the curvature corrections on the gravity side. While in other examples, it's possible that the phase structure will actually be different here, and that tells us that there would be some critical coupling in the middle where the phase structure changes. So these are basically the general possibilities that can happen. And so in this talk, I'll discuss two examples of this general structure and illustrate everything that I said. So are there any questions first about the general story? Okay, so let me start by briefly reviewing the first example of black hole formation in anti-de Sitter space. So let's take the famous duality between type 2B string theory on ADS5 cross S5. And n equals 4 FUN supering Mills theory. And we can study the string theory on the ADS5 in global coordinates. And then this is mapped to having this n equals 4 supering Mills theory compactified on a 3-sphere of some radius r, where, of course, the precise value of the radius doesn't matter because this is a conformal theory. And we can then study the phase structure on these two sides, both in the microcanonical ensemble and in the canonical ensemble. Probably won't have time. I mean, there's also an interesting story in the microcanonical ensemble, but I probably won't have time for that. So let me just describe the canonical story here. So let's start from the gravity side. So on the gravity side, if one studies, so first of all, in ADS space, unlike in flat space, there is a canonical ensemble also for theories of gravity, because there is no Jeans instability in ADS space that prevents one from discussing the canonical ensemble. And of course, that's necessary for this agreement to the field theory where we always have the canonical ensemble. So one can study the string theory on global ADS in the canonical ensemble. One way to do it, of course, is just to use the fact that the canonical ensemble is the same as the Euclidean partition function with the time direction identified with the periodicity, which is the inverse temperature. So we can just look at Euclidean solutions that are asymptotically ADS 5 cross S 5, and each one of these solutions corresponds to some phase of this classical gravity theory, and we can see which phases dominate at different temperatures. And there are basically two different phases for this theory. One phase corresponds to the solution which is just a gas of particles in anti-de Sitter space. And as a gravitational solution, that's basically just the same solution as global ADS, just with the time direction periodically identified. And if we look at the topology of the solution, so these global anti-de Sitter spaces, as one goes to the boundary, their topology looks like a product of S1 times S3. And in the solution corresponding to the gas of, and in the usual anti-de Sitter space, global anti-de Sitter space, this S3 shrinks as one goes to the origin. I mean, that's sort of the definition of the origin. And then the solution corresponding to the gas of particles, then that's still true. Namely, there is a circle that does not shrink, while the S3 shrinks as a function of the radial direction in anti-de Sitter space. So that's one solution, which is a saddle point of this canonical partition function. And the other solution is known as the ADS black hole. And this other solution has a different topology. Since it's a black hole, then it has a horizon, meaning that the Euclidean time direction shrinks to a point somewhere. So this circle is contractible in that topology, while the S3 is actually uncontractible. So at least classically, these are completely different phases, since they have a different topology. And one can compute the classical gravitational action, which one identifies with the free energy of both of these phases, and see if there is a phase transition. And this was first done by Hawking and Page, who found that there is indeed a phase transition between these two phases. And when translated to field theory language, so there is a phase transition. So at low temperatures, the gas of particles phase dominates. At high temperatures, the ADS black hole dominates. And there's a transition between them that, in classical gravity, happens at a temperature which is 3 over 2 pi r. So that's a well-known story that's, I guess, around for 20 years now. So that's the gravity story. Now we want to translate it to the field theory. So first we have to understand what type of phase transition this is from the field theory point of view. So for that, we have to understand what the order parameters are that distinguish these two sides. So as I said, well, the order parameter is basically the topology, but we need to phrase that in a more precise language corresponding to some observable. And this was done by Witten, who noticed that one observable that distinguishes between these two sides comes from looking at strings that end on this circle in the boundary. So if we have a Wilson loop in this field theory around some curve, then that maps on the anti-de Sitter side to having a string that ends on the same cycle in the boundary. And now in this phase, we can have a string that's wrapped around the circle, because the circle is contractible, so we can have a smooth world sheet that ends on the circle in the boundary. On the other hand, on this phase, if we try to have a string that wraps around the circle, then we find that we just can't do it with a smooth world sheet, because the circle is uncontractible. So when one considers this observable of the Wilson loop, then that means that in this phase, this Wilson loop around this time direction can be non-vanishing, because there are some configurations that give non-zero contribution to it. Well, here, at least in the classical string theory, this Wilson loop vanishes, because there are no configurations that give rise to it. So So that's one way to answer this question that was there before of how we translate these statements about topology and classical gravity into precise statements about order parameters. So here, the order parameter that distinguishes between them is the Wilson loop. And again, all these statements are true just in the classical gravity approximation. Here, if you would try to compute this beyond classical gravity, then the Wilson loop would get some contributions because it's not just given by these classical worksheets anymore. But in the classical gravity approximation, this is a sharp phase transition, which is distinguished by this order parameter. Now, what does this phase transition mean on the field theory side? So this Wilson loop is really a... So this operator W that I defined is really the Wilson loop around this periodic time direction. The circle corresponds to the periodic time direction in the gauge theory. So that's what's usually called a Polyakov loop in the gauge theory. And in gauge theory, this is a standard order parameter for the confinement-deconfinement phase transition, because this order parameter measures basically the free energy of some external quark that we put into the theory. And in the confined phase, we know that it costs an infinite energy to put in an external quark, while in a deconfined phase, we know that it costs a finite energy. So we can translate this W non-zero into a deconfined phase of this SUN gauge theory, while the W equals zero phase corresponds to a confined phase of the gauge theory. So now that, so this is sort of the translation stage, and now that we know how to translate, then we can first of all work at strong coupling. So at strong coupling, what this tells us is that in this n equals 4 Young-Mills theory, so we know that for lambda equals infinity, this theory has a deconfinement phase transition that happens at a temperature which is 3 over 2 pi r. So that's one thing that this teaches us. Unfortunately, in this case, we don't know how to solve the strongly coupled gauge theory directly, so we don't know how to check if this is true or not. But in principle, if we had strong enough computers, we could just simulate it and check if it's true or not. But nobody's done that yet. What we can do on the field theory side is we can ask what happens at weak coupling. So it's not too hard to do the computation on the field theory side at weak coupling and see if there is a similar phase transition or not. And what you find is that indeed, also at weak coupling, there is a phase transition between these two phases, which happens at a temperature which is 1 over r times log of 7 plus 4 square root of 3. And these two temperatures are actually not too far from each other. They only differ by 20% or so. So in this case, we see that the qualitative behavior of these theories at weak coupling and at strong coupling is very similar, and even the quantitatively, they only differ by some 20% or so. So it seems that, at least as far as this phase structure is concerned, turning on the coupling constant here or turning on the stringy corrections here doesn't really change much. And for any value of the coupling, we have these two phases, and we have, which here just correspond to the gas of particles and the black hole. And it seems like for any value of the coupling, we just have a phase transition between them at some critical temperature. So that was a brief review of that story. So questions now? Now I have to remember. Let's see. I think this one is higher. And yeah, this one is higher. And actually here, people have also computed the leading corrections to that in a power series in lambda. And you can see that as a power series of lambda, this starts going up when you turn on the coupling. And this is actually a higher value. And presumably, well, I guess it could be just a monotonic function that goes up all the way to the strong coupling behavior. Nobody really knows how to control it for intermediate values of the coupling. So we don't know. But it's consistent that if you plot t as a function of lambda, then it looks like it just behaves something like this with smooth limits on both sides and just rising. Now, on this side, it's also known that it's a first-order phase transition. On this side, it's not yet known if the transition is first-order or second-order, and we're busy doing a computation that will tell us if it's first-order or second-order on this side, but this has not yet been done. Here? Actually, I'm not sure. You would probably know better than I do. it hasn't been done here? Okay. Right, but here, okay, so it would be interesting to see what, so here there would be some correction that some number over square root lambda, and it would be interesting to see what's the sign. Well, I don't know. I mean, nobody promises us that this has to be monotonic, right? So I don't know. I mean, usually functions are monotonic, but they don't have to be. So I don't know if we should have strong prejudices about that. So anyway, so this concludes part two of a brief example. So are there any questions about that before I go on to the main feature? Okay. Here? Well, you can right. So you can think of it as a Gross-Witten type thing. This is a field theory on S3, so it's essentially just a matrix model, and you can translate this phase transition into a Gross-Witten transition in this matrix model. It's not precisely a Gross-Witten transition. Well, it will be easier for me to explain that later on because when I discuss the black hole black string, because it's very similar also there. So maybe you can ask the question of it again later. Okay. So let's now discuss the black hole black string transition. So this is a famous phase transition in gravity when we take spaces that look like RD minus 1 times S1, namely that asymptotically have some circle. And if we consider these theories of gravity in the microcanonical ensemble, then there are two possible phases. So if we look at a generic state, so if this is the circle direction, which has some radius r, so if we consider the rather light state in this theory, whose mass is much bigger than the Planck scale, but still relatively light, then the generic states are just going to be small black holes that are localized on the circle. So when these states are light, then their Schwarzschild radius is much less than the radius of the circle. And the generic state looks approximately just like a d-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole. So these states are approximately d-dimensional Schwarzschild with some corrections that come from the interactions between this black hole and its images, but these corrections are small when the mass is small. So this is the dominant phase in the microcanonical ensemble for relatively small masses. On the other hand, as we increase the mass, then the black hole horizon grows and grows, and eventually it fills the whole circle. And then when the black hole is very large, then the solution actually looks something like this, where the black hole winds all around the circle. Namely, so this is the black hole phase. And here we have a black hole that winds all around the circle, so it's better to call it a black string. And these solutions, so one solution of this type is just the d minus one dimensional Schwarzschild solution times the circle. And that's actually an exact solution, which always exists. So that's one example of a solution like this. And there may also be other solutions which are non-uniform. So this solution is uniform around the circle. It's symmetric under translations around the circle. There are also other solutions that are not invariant under translations, but that also have, well, the same general picture. And these are, again, two different phases in the classical approximation because they have a different topology. In this case, the horizon topology, so here the horizon topology is SD minus 2. Well, for these solutions, the horizon is SD minus 3 cross S1. So it's at least, again, well, not at least, just classically, these solutions have a different horizon. So they are different phases, and one can indeed write down order parameters that will distinguish them just like in the previous case. So these are sort of the two. So these are the pictures in the two extreme limits: a very small mass and very large mass. And the precise nature of the phase diagram for this system and of the transition between these two phases has been investigated very extensively in the last 3 years, mostly by people like Barakol and Toby Wiseman and others. And by now, there's a very convincing picture of what this phase diagram looks like from the gravity side, by many numerical studies that have been done of the system and a few analytical solutions. So let me just give you the results for what is the full phase structure of the system look like. And I'll draw it in a graph of mass versus non-uniformity, where I won't define exactly what I mean by non-uniformity, but it's easy to see more or less. So more or less what one means by non-uniformity is the size of the breaking of the translation invariance along the circle. And one can make that, of course, more precise in various ways. I'll only be interested in the schematic features here, so it won't really matter. So if I draw these solutions on this graph, so as I said, one solution, which is always an exact solution, is the d minus 1 dimensional Schwarzschild times S1, and that's exactly uniform. So that solution lives here. So that's the uniform black string solution. And as we follow, try to follow that solution to small masses, so it shrinks and shrinks, and eventually it looks something like this. And this system was studied by Gregory and Laflamme about 10 years ago, and they found that there is some minimal mass, or, well, some value of the mass or of this horizon radius, such that below that value of the mass, the system is unstable. So there is some point here where the system develops a Gregory-Laflamme instability. So that the solutions above this point are stable, and the solutions below that point are unstable. So that's one branch of, so that's one phase of this theory. Another phase is the small black hole phase. So these are non-uniform solutions that exist down to arbitrary low mass as well. So that branch is somewhere here. And the picture of the phase diagram based on simulations and so on is that there is another branch of solution that comes out of here. So exactly where this instability forms exactly, there's actually a, sort of an exactly marginal deformation that one can turn on to these solutions, which turns on a very small non-uniformity. And it was found that the full branch structure seems to behave like this, where this is the black hole branch. This is a non-uniform black string branch. And this branch is always unstable, at least in 13 dimensions or smaller. It was found that this branch of solutions is always unstable. And what seems to happen, based on, again, on numerical simulations and a few analytic results, is that these two branches of the black hole and the non-uniform black string join together, more or less smoothly, in a topology changing transition that happens here at some intermediate value of the mass. So this is the more or less well accepted now, I think, picture of the phase structure of this theory. And if we ask what's the dominant phase of the theory in the microcanonical ensemble at different energies, so of course at low energies the system prefers to be in the black hole phase, and then there is some point here where the entropy of this black hole becomes equal to the entropy of the black string, and there's a transition to this black string phase that then dominates for higher energies. So if we discuss the system in the microcanonical ensemble, then there would be a phase transition at some critical mass that sits somewhere around here. So I should emphasize that the discussion here is only for static solutions of gravity. I mean, everything that I said now is just about static solutions, and there are many interesting questions involving the dynamics of the system, which I'll come back to briefly at the end. So that's a quick summary of the gravity side. Are there any questions about that before I try to translate it to field theory? Okay. So this is an interesting system. I mean, it's interesting from many points of view, and one as a gravitational system exhibiting a phase transition, and of course it would be interesting to translate this system into gravity and to try to learn to field theory, sorry, and to learn about it from the field theory point of view. So we want to translate all of these solutions to field theory somehow. Of course, the problem is that here we're talking about black hole solutions in asymptotically fast space, and for those we don't have any field theory dual, or at least we don't know any field theory dual. So we can't just directly translate these solutions to a field theory. We have to do something to them first, but there is a procedure that allows us to translate these solutions one-to-one to solutions of a different system, which do have a mapping to a dual field theory. So let me describe that. So first of all, of course, in order to map this to a field theory, we have to first embed this into a consistent theory of quantum gravity. So we have to take d equals 10 and discuss this in a string theory, and let me take d equals 10 and discuss this in type 2a string theory on S1. So that's, of course, just a specific case of this general story, which applies in any dimension, and when we're at weak string coupling and at large masses, then this classical gravity story is a good approximation to the full story in this type 2a string theory. Now, we can take these, so we can view all of these solutions that are drawn here as solutions of this type 2a string theory, and with very small stringy corrections. Now, given these solutions, which are solutions of type 2a on F1, we can lift them to M theory in the usual way by identifying the dilaton with the radius of the 11th dimension in type 2a string theory. So when we can map these solutions to solutions of M theory on T2, and in that context, these solutions are wrapped on the additional 11th circle because these solutions don't have any Ramond-Ramond fields and so on, so they're lifted just by adding another circle to the solutions. So far we haven't done much, but now after lifting them to 11 dimensions, we can take these solutions and boost them along this X11 dimension, so that we can always just take a classical solution and boost it. And what this does is it generates for us a solution which is still a solution of M theory on T2 wrapped on this S1, but now with non-zero momentum in this 11th direction. And after doing that, we can again reduce to the type 2a string theory And when we do that, then this momentum in the 11th dimension becomes a de zero brain charge. So these solutions now become solutions of type 2a on S1 with a de zero brain charge. And so each of these solutions, when we do this procedure to it, it's mapped to a solution that carries some specific de zero brain charge depending on how much we boosted. Now, the advantage of doing that is that for these solutions that have a de zero brain charge, then we know that there is a limit where they are well described by a field theory, which is the limit where these solutions are near extremal, namely where the mass of these black solutions above extremalities is much smaller than the mass which is the minimal extremal mass coming from the de zero brain charge. And the limit that makes these solutions near extremal is the limit of large boost. So if we do this procedure with a very large boost, which eventually we'll want to take to infinity, then that generates for us from each of these solutions a near extremal solution of type 2a string theory on S1. And then these near extremal solutions, by the usual generalizations of Malvasena's ADS CFT correspondence, we can just translate them into a field theory. So naively, one might think that they would be translated into some quantum mechanical theory that lives on these D0 brains. But in fact, that's not true. If one analyzes this in more detail, one sees that in this picture, the winding strings along this S1 are still important also in this decoupling limit corresponding to the near extremality. So one can't ignore them. So one way to think about the system is a system of D0 brains plus all these winding strings around the S1. But a simpler description arises if we now just do a T-duality along the circle, and then that translates these solutions into solutions of type 2b on S1 with D1 brains wrapped on this S1. And then these D1 brains include already all these winding modes as well. And again, T-duality is again, just a classical symmetry of gravity, so we can use it to translate any of these solutions to solutions of this type 2b string theory. And now here, by the generalization of the ADS-CFT correspondence, we know that this system is dual to some UN maximally symmetric Cyprien Yang-Mills theory in 1 plus 1 dimensions, which is compactified on S1. So when you translate into the gauge theory side, you still have this S1. So by using this full chain of dualities and arguments, we can take each of these solutions of classical gravity and view them as solutions of this type 2a string theory, do all these transformations, and map them to a configuration in this specific field theory, namely in the UN maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory in 1 plus 1 dimensions, compactified on a circle. So this gives us the translation that we want between these gravitational solutions and the field theory. So now we can translate each of these solutions to the field theory, and we can ask what in the field theory is the order parameter that distinguishes between these different phases, and we can analyze the phase transition, these phase transitions in the field theory language, both at recoupling and at strong coupling. So are there any questions about this translation procedure? Okay. So what's the order parameter that distinguishes between these different phases? So basically, well, it's sort of obvious that the difference between the black hole and the black string is whether the solution is localized along the circle or not. And the circle basically goes for the ride when this is one which is the one that existed already in the original picture, basically goes for the ride when we do these dualities. So a solution here that had a black hole corresponds here to a solution where the D0 brains were localized on the S1, while the black string solution maps on this side to a solution where the D1 brains are smeared along the S1. Now, when we do the T-duality, then the position of these D0 brains gets mapped to a Wilson loop in the 1 plus 1 dimensional theory living on the D1 brains. So the positions of the D0 brains become the eigenvalues of the Wilson loop in this field theory, just by the usual rules of T-duality. So in order to measure from the point of view of this gauge theory what are the positions of the D0 brains, we need to look again at a Wilson loop operator. But this Wilson loop operator is now in the spatial direction, so we have to look at the path ordered integral of ax dx, where this x is the spatial circle in the CH theory. And the eigenvalues of this Wilson loop map to the positions of the D0 brains in the other picture. And now if we take the larger limit, which we're interested in taking, then there's a continuous distribution of these eigenvalues. And then one possibility for the way that this distribution looks like is that it could be localized. So I'm drawing here now the eigenvalue distribution for the eigenvalues. So if these eigenvalues are some e to the I lambda, I'm drawing the eigenvalue density for these eigenvalues in the Laurentian limit. So one possibility is that these eigenvalues would be localized. And by this mapping, we identify this phase with the black hole phase. And another possibility is that these eigenvalues could just be completely uniformly distributed between pi and minus pi. And again, based on that translation, we identify this phase with the uniform black string phase. And there could, again, just like in the gravity picture, there could be some intermediate phase where the eigenvalue distribution looks something like this, so that it's not uniform, but it still fills the whole circle. And it's natural to identify this with the non-uniform black string phase. So this is how we translate the characteristics of these different gravitational solutions into the gauge theory. So we expect that there should be solutions like this in the configurations like this in the gauge theory with an exactly uniform eigenvalue distribution, configurations here corresponding to this localized eigenvalue distribution, and in the middle somewhere these non-uniform black string configurations. And again, I should emphasize that the distinctions between these two phases, just like in the gravity side, there was only a distinction in the classical gravity limit, and we don't expect any distinction for finite string coupling. Also here, for finite n, these are not really continuous functions. They're just discrete eigenvalues. So for finite n, there's no real distinction between this distribution and this distribution. The distinction really only arises for infinite n. So also from the field theory point of view, these are only phase transitions in the infinite n limit. So that's sort of just a consistency check. Sorry? Well, I thought that it is precisely defined. So I'm now discussing this one plus one dimensional gauge theory. Say I can say that I do it in the canonical ensemble. Now that we've moved to the gauge theory, we can also discuss it in the canonical ensemble. So there are some saddle points in the canonical ensemble for the behavior of these different fields. And I can just examine this is some operator, and I can compute it in the saddle point, compute the eigenvalues of this operator are just phases. I mean, it's a unitary matrix. So just compute the distribution of these eigenvalues on the saddle point, and that distribution could take, in principle, one of these three forms. At least these are the simplest examples, and that's what one actually finds. So each of these solutions is supposed to correspond to some saddle point of that Euclidean functional integral in this gauge theory, and the distribution in that saddle point could take one of these three forms. And let's see. For finite n, I mean, sure. That's only true for infinite n. I mean, that wouldn't be true for finite n. But it wouldn't distinguish this. I mean, it would distinguish this phase from the other two, but it wouldn't distinguish between these two phases. That's right, but nothing diverges. But nothing diverges in the field theory at finite n when you get to this sort of borderline distribution between them. There isn't anything that diverges here. So at finite n, you couldn't really tell the difference. The only order parameter that distinguishes, right, exactly. So that's all that I was saying. So I guess we agree on that. Okay, so now that we know how to translate these gravitational statements into field theory, so we can start by working again on the strongly coupled side. So on the strongly coupled side, we know what the phase structure is from this gravity analysis, and we can just translate that into predictions about the behavior of this strongly coupled field theory. So we have a prediction from gravity about this strongly coupled 1 plus 1 dimensional Super-Young-Mills theory. And, well, we can get the prediction just by translating this phase diagram to the field theory side. as I mentioned, after we've taken this new horizon limit, we can also work in the canonical ensemble because it does become well-defined here. So I can translate that phase diagram into some canonical phase diagram where I just derive things as a function of temperature and say minus the free energy such that the higher the phase here is, the more dominant it is in the partition function. And what gravity tells us is that at low temperatures, the dominant phase is going to be this black hole phase, which then would end at some specific temperature, which is the point marked over there on the graph. Then we know that at high temperatures, we're going to be dominated by this uniform black string phase. Again, I'm just taking the solutions from that graph and just writing them in different variables, which are free energy and temperature instead of mass and non-uniformity, but it's something that one can compute just given the same gravitational solutions. And then we know that this phase becomes unstable at some point, so there's this unstable. So here we have the unstable uniform black string phase, and here in the middle we have the unstable non-uniform black string. So from the gravity, we can predict exactly what the properties of all these phases should be and what should be the critical temperature where we have a phase transition between them. And gravity also tells us precisely what should be the free energy in all these different phases. So for instance, in this phase, the free energy is predicted to be n squared t cubed L over lambda, where lambda is the Hooft coupling of this one plus fundamental gauge theory, which has dimensions of mass squared. And in this phase, gravity predicts that the free energy should be n squared t to the 14/5 lambda to the minus 3/5 divided by L to the 3/5, where I guess I sort of find. So L is the radius of this S1 that the field theory is compactified on. So again, so given each of these solutions, I can just translate it here into some statement about the field theory. I can compute its free energy and its mass and so on, and all its other thermodynamical properties from the gravity, and just translate them through this change of dualities to statements about this field theory. And these are the statements that are found. Unfortunately, this is a pretty complicated field theory, even though it's in one plus one dimensions, it's supersymmetric and so on. So it's pretty hard to simulate this theory at strong coupling. It would be very interesting to see if these predictions are really correct or not. Certainly, there is some pretty weird behavior here, especially these 14/5 and so on. So this is a pretty weird prediction about the behavior of these strongly coupled field theories. But unfortunately, we don't yet know any way to check it directly. Just one second. So one thing which I forgot to say is, what is the range of validity of this picture? So these are predictions for the strongly coupled gauge theory, which apply whenever gravity is really a good approximation. So we have to translate the question of when we have here weak coupling and small curvatures and so on, we have to translate that into the field theory parameters. And the range of validity of this picture is that the coupling has to be strong in units of this radius L, which means that lambda L squared has to be much bigger than 1. And also, the temperature has to be smaller than lambda L squared to the minus 1/6. But this critical temperature turns out to scale as 1 over, or p crit times L, turns out to scale as 1 over square root of lambda L squared if I write everything in dimensionless quantities. So this is certainly well within the range of validity of gravity. So gravity gives us a prediction for the behavior of the field theory in this range of parameters, but unfortunately we don't know how to check it directly. So in the rest of this talk, I'll describe what we can do in the case of the weakly coupled field theory and to what extent it gives us a similar picture to this or not. So questions? Actually, it is very important, even at finite temperature. No, the scalars are important, but also the fermions are very important in this case. I mean, for... Right. That's right. Right, obviously, for the high temperature behavior, I mean, so this behavior can probably analyze far along this axis. And there, the fermions are really not important, but this behavior is much tougher to get at. And we're all describing the weakly coupled field theories, basically, as far as I know, the state of the art of what can be done about these theories. I've looked at them, but not in much detail. It would certainly be interesting if one could use them to see something like this. So that's certainly an interesting project. Usually, it's pretty hard to do just because the...
I mean, they've done a lot of work on theory.
That's right, but the work that has been done has not been in this large N limit. And the large N limit is very hard to do in, from the point of view of these DLCQs, because you have to take large momentum and large N and so on. And well, so it's, as far as I know, this has not been done yet, but it certainly would be very interesting to do this. And in principle, it's possible if one has strong enough computers. But it hasn't been done yet. Okay, so let's see, what should I erase? So I think I can erase this now. So what we tried to do, so far, basically, none of this was really part of our work. All this is the review of other people's work. So what we did was we tried to analyze this, the same phase structure at weak coupling, to see if the phase structure at weak coupling is similar to this or not, and that way to see if coupling constant effects or string curvature effects change these phase transitions or not. So let me know. So what we did was try to do a weak coupling analysis of the phase structure of this theory. And this theory, again, is just a 1 plus 1 dimensional maximally supersymmetric Young-Mills theory. So we have compactified on a circle. So the x direction is periodic with some period L. And we have the gauge field. We have 8 scalar fields. We have the usual interactions between them, commutator squared. And we have all the fermions and so on. I mean, the details are not so important, but anyway, it's not a very complicated theory. And what we need to do to analyze it is to analyze the theory at finite temperature, so to compactify the time direction on a circle of radius 1 over t, and just to find the large n saddle points of this functional integral. And these should map to these phases. Well, if these phases exist also at weak coupling, then we should find them just by looking at the saddle points of this functional integral. Okay. And so at each such saddle point, there is some eigenvalue distribution. We can just compute it and see if it's in this black hole phase or in uniform black string phase or a non-uniform black string and try to map the, well, try to draw a similar figure for the case of the weakly coupled field theory. And as I said, well, we don't know how to analyze this theory at strong coupling, but in principle, we should be able to analyze this theory at weak coupling. Unfortunately, even at weak coupling, it's not so easy, because in this theory, the coupling constant is dimensionful, so this lambda has dimensions of mass squared. So these theories are always weakly coupled at high energies, but they always become strongly coupled at low energies. So what one means by weakly coupled is that the coupling constant should be weak at the scales 1 over L, say corresponding to the circle, or at the scale of the temperature. But in this theory, we always have zero modes, so the scalar fields and also the gauge fields have zero modes on the circle. And the zero modes, unfortunately, are always living at zero energy. So they're always strongly coupled. So we can never really just do a perturbative computation. So we would have liked to do, some perturbative computation of these eigenvalue distributions, like it was possible to do in this other example of the black hole formation in ADS phase transition. But here, the zero modes are always strongly coupled. So we can never completely trust perturbation theory. So we have to do something beyond perturbation theory. Now, what's the best we can do? So the best we can hope for is that everything else should be weakly coupled, and then we'll just be left with a theory of the zero modes. And there is some regime where that's true. So as we said, the zero modes are always strongly coupled, and then one can analyze how strongly the zero mode interacts with these other modes. And when the coupling constant is small enough, then the interactions of the zero modes with these higher modes that live at energies 1 over L or the temperature will be small. And we can include all the other modes perturbatively after we solve for the zero modes. And if you compute it, then it turns out that there is some range of temperatures where that's true. And it turns out that this is true when the temperature is much smaller than 1 over lambda squared and much bigger than lambda L squared to the 1/3. So at this temperature, the spatial Toulouse-Klein modes become strongly coupled, and at this temperature, the Toulouse-Klein modes along the time direction become strongly coupled. But between these two ranges of temperature, then the whole system then all the massive modes are weakly coupled, and we can just analyze the zero modes. Now, of course, in order to have a non-zero range here, it's obvious that lambda L squared has to be much smaller than one, so we have to be So this coupling has to be small, and of course, there's no overlap between this range and the range here where gravity is valid, as we expect. I mean, we don't expect to have any overlap between the ranges of perturbation theory and of string theory. So So let me start by analyzing what happens in this range of temperatures. So in this range of temperatures, again, the effects of all the massive modes is negligible, and we can just analyze the dynamics of the zero modes. Let's see, what should I erase? I can probably erase this now since I'm on the left. Right, so this is going to be a first approximation. Of course, I'm going to improve on that, but yes, your guess is right, and we'll see that very explicitly. And of course, we're going to have to go beyond this because we do want to study the phase transition, but this is sort of the first approximation that we can do. So in this range, then, basically the partition function is a good approximation just given by the partition function of the zero modes. The fermions don't have any zero modes. We just have 8 zero modes from the scalar field and 2 more zero modes for the gauge field. So the partition function just reduces to a partition function of 10 scalar matrices. So this is just a matrix integral over 10 matrices. Again, 2 coming from the gauge field and 8 from the scalar fields with an action which is just this very simple action. And again, this is just a matrix integral. And this matrix integral is strongly coupled. I mean, we can't analyze this perturbatively. But since it's a matrix integral, then it's not that tough to just simulate it and see what the answers are. And of course, we're interested again in the distributions of the eigenvalues of the fields there, which map into distributions of the eigenvalues of these matrices psi here. At first sight, it would look like this integral diverges because the action of this matrix integral vanishes whenever all the matrices commute with each other. So classically, this theory has a big moduli space where all the matrices commute, and you would think that this integral just diverges and makes no sense. But in fact, when you include the quantum effects, then they turn out to give an attractive force between the eigenvalues of these matrices, and it turns out that this matrix integral does converge, and there is a good saddle point for this matrix integral in the larger limit, and people have computed numerically what the saddle point looks like, and at that saddle point, there is some distribution for the eigenvalues of each of these matrices psi, which looks something like this, where the average range of these psi's. So if you compute, say, the 1 over n times the trace of a product of all these matrices, then this is approximately 2.5. So one can really compute very explicitly what this eigenvalue distribution is at the saddle point. And that's been done a few years ago. So that gives us the precise solution in this range of temperatures. Now, here we get it for all these 10 matrices. What we're interested in, I remind you, is the eigenvalue distribution of the specific field that corresponds to the one component of the gauge field, of the x component of the gauge field. But that's just one of these, that's proportional to one of these matrices. So this gives us also the distribution of this x field. And of course, that tells us that distribution is really localized. So if we translate that into here, then it's localized. So that tells us that in this regime, we're always in the black hole phase. So that tells us that in this whole range of temperatures, we're always in the black hole phase. So that's maybe not too, well, okay. Anyway, that's what we find by doing the analysis. Now, where does this picture break down? So here I've assumed that these are just scalar matrices with no conditions on them. But two of these matrices come from components of the gauge field. So two of them come from A0 and A1, and the other ones come from the scalar field. And for the ones that come from the gauge field, then, of course, the gauge fields are really periodic variables due to large gauge transformations, since they're gauge fields on circles. So the psi that come from the gauge fields are really periodic. But in this range of temperatures, then this periodicity is much bigger than the width of this distribution, so it doesn't really have any effect. Now, what happens as we raise the temperature is that eventually the periodicity of the psi, which comes from A1, becomes comparable to the width of this eigenvalue distribution, so that as you raise the temperature, then the periodicity starts becoming comparable to this width, and that happens exactly when the temperature becomes of order 1 over lambda L squared. So as you raise the temperature, eventually the periodicity becomes comparable to this width, and you might expect that at that temperature there would be this phase transition where the eigenvalues start filling the whole circle. Now, of course, this temperature, not surprisingly, is exactly the same temperature where our approximation breaks down, because once this periodicity becomes important, then also the Kaluza Klein modes around the circle becomes important, and we have to include also the effects of these modes. So from this sort of picture, we know that we might expect to have a phase transition happening at a temperature of this order, but in order to really analyze it, we have to include also the effects of these spatial Toulouse Lautrec modes, and we can't just work with the integral, with this matrix integral. So that's what we did. I mean, so what we have, so this best that we can hope for turns out not to be enough, and what we have to do is to analyze temperatures of this order, and in order to do that, we have to include all these spatial Toulouse Lautrec modes around the circle. But the nice thing is that we can still ignore all the Kalutta-Klein modes along the time direction because they are all still weakly coupled and don't have a strong effect. And in particular, we can ignore all the fermions because the fermions are all antiperiodic around this time direction. So they're all very massive and weakly coupled. And we just have to include the bosonic fields, the zero modes of the bosonic field on this time circle and all of the Kalutta-Klein modes on this spatial circle. So this regime can be analyzed just by analyzing a zero plus one-dimensional gauge theory, which does not have any fermions. It's just a gauge theory with 9 adjoint scalar fields, where, 8 of them come from the original scalars, and the other one comes from A0. Now, this gauge theory is strongly coupled, so we have to, at this temperature, so we have to analyze this strongly coupled gauge theory. But we still don't have to include all the effects of the fermions and all the things that complicate numerical simulations. So this gauge theory is not so hard to simulate, and so what we did was we just simulated the strongly coupled gauge theory in order to see what the phase structure is at different temperatures. So we just did Monte Carlo simulations of this gauge theory, computed the average, the expectation values of this eigenvalue distributions, and saw what the answer is. And so what we found from the simulation is that there is indeed a phase transition. So as we said, at low temperatures, we know that we're in this black hole phase, and we found that there is indeed a phase transition happening to a phase of uniform eigenvalues, and this phase transition happens at a temperature which is 1.4 divided by lambda L squared. So this is the result of many numerical simulations that we did at different temperatures, and we find that there is a phase transition that happens precisely at this range. Again, this is, the phase transition becomes sharp only in the large M limit, as usual, when these eigenvalue distributions are well-defined, and it becomes smoothed out for finite N, but it turns out that we did simulations for values of N that were around 6, 12, 20, and 30, and so on, and already for N equals 12 or 20 or something like that, it was, the phase transition was already quite sharp, so we could really, see it by eye, basically, by looking at these distributions. So what we know now, so this is the picture of strong coupling, and our numerical results allow us to draw these results at weak coupling, and at weak coupling we find a pretty similar picture. So again, at low temperatures there is this black hole phase, and then there is a phase transition to a black string phase. From our numerical simulations, we don't find, it seems that this transition happens exactly directly from the black hole phase to the black string phase, like it is at strong coupling, but it's also possible that there is some very small regime here where the non-uniform black string dominates. That's really hard to distinguish numerically. But anyway, the main features of the phase diagram seem to be the same at weak coupling and at strong coupling. By our simulations, we can only analyze what's the dominant configuration at a given temperature, so we can't see these unstable phases. But at least for the dominant phases, the phase diagram seems to be completely identical at weak coupling and at strong coupling, with the only difference being in the precise values of where the phase transition happens. So here the phase transition happens, when you're at weak coupling, it happens at a temperature that goes like 1 over lambda, while at strong coupling, it happens at a temperature that goes like 1 over square root lambda. So in this case, the difference between weak coupling and strong coupling is slightly more pronounced than it was in the previous example of black holes and ADS, but still the qualitative features of the phase diagram seem to be exactly the same at weak coupling and strong coupling, indicating that from the field theory point of view, strong coupling effects don't really change the phase structure dramatically, and on the string theory side, that adding string curvature corrections also doesn't change the dynamics very much. Yes. Well, again, just like here, they don't give any problems. I mean, when you do the simulations, then you are including the effects of all the off-diagonal modes, and these off-diagonal modes do give you an attractive potential between the eigenvalues. I mean, the simulations are really for the full matrices, and of which part? Well, certainly in the simulations, we do the simulations and we find that there are no problems, and people also did this for the matrix integral. But also, I mean, you can just compute, right? I mean, you can compute what happens for very large eigenvalue separations and see that there really is an attractive potential at that regime, where you can just do perturbation theory and see it. Again, we can't do any computations here in this strongly coupled theory, so all we know how to do is the simulations, but there's no reason why there shouldn't be any problems with these simulations, and indeed we found that there are no problems. And so maybe just one more comment before I finish. So this gauge theory is strongly coupled, but we can also do these numerical simulations in a somewhat different theory by giving a mass to these scalars. So of course, from the field theory side, nothing prevents us also just from giving a mass to all these scalars. And if the mass of these scalars is very large, then perturbation theory is valid once this mass becomes much bigger than the scale set by the gauge coupling. So we actually did these simulations also at different values of the mass, and for large values of the mass, we can compute these phase diagrams perturbatively, and we see a precise agreement between the numerical results for large mass and the perturbative results. Of course, the situation where we give a mass doesn't really have any translation to the gravity language, so the only thing that we know how to translate to the gravity is the massless case, and that's also the hard case. But in that case, we did these numerical simulations, and again, as far as we can see, they give us a trustworthy prediction for this phase diagram. So let me just summarize. So I've provided some examples of how we can use the map between field theory and string theory to give us a new perspective on gravitational field theories, and in particular, this map translates black holes and various other gravitational states into just standard configurations in field theory, which can easily be analyzed. And what we found in both of these examples, actually, is that the analysis at weak coupling seems to be very similar to what gravity tells us at strong coupling. So we have a nice consistent picture where changing the coupling doesn't really seem to change much about the qualitative features of the theory. And that can sort of increase our confidence that we really understand what's going on here on the gravity side. So say on the gravity side, people have conjectured that there might be other phases here in this phase diagram and so on. At least in the field theory analysis, we don't see any other phases. So maybe that's some indication that these phases are also not there on the gravity side, although in principle they could show up just at strong coupling, but we don't have any way to study that directly. Now, in particular, in the case of this particular phase transition, there has been an interesting paper by Horowitz and Maeda where they argued that if one looks at the dynamical process of the black string decay, then they argued that it should take an infinite time for the black string to decay into a black hole, so they conjectured that maybe there's some intermediate phase that the black string would decay into. Now, we did not study the dynamical process. Everything that I said so far was just about static solutions, but at least this translation to the field theory suggests that there shouldn't be any obstruction of this black string phase to go into a black hole phase in finite time. Certainly, from the field theory point of view, there's no obstruction to that. So that suggests that perhaps, at least when the string curvature corrections are taken into account, it suggests that there shouldn't be any obstruction here also on the gravity side. Or, well, of course, it's also possible that this obstruction only turns on at some intermediate coupling, but we don't see any sign of it, at least in our weak coupling analysis. And the bottom line is that the picture in the gravity and at strong coupling and at weak coupling is very similar, and the only difference is on the gravity side, we find a 1 over square root lambda behavior, on the field theory side, a 1 over lambda behavior, and that's quite similar to other differences that have been found between weak coupling and strong coupling behavior. For instance, in the n equals 40-Mills theory, it's known that the force between a quark and an anti-quark at weak coupling goes like lambda, and at strong coupling like square root lambda, and this seems to be a very similar type of change between the weak coupling and the strong coupling behavior, so perhaps that's sort of a generic feature that whenever you have something at weak coupling that behaves like lambda, then at strong coupling it behaves like square root lambda. Unfortunately, we don't really understand yet where that comes from, but that's what we find in our analysis. So thank you.